Good evening. Welcome to Third Thursday Community Conversation. I'm Jay Anderson. Each month we sit down with an interesting guest for an in-depth exchange of thoughts and ideas, opinions and points of view, professional and personal. She grew up in Puerto Rico, spent 15 years as a cloistered nun in New Jersey, and then fell in love with an Italian priest. She left her order and married the priest when he left the priesthood. Shortly after their two children were born, her story turned tragic. Years later, she moved to the North Shore, where Lake Superior helped heal and energize her. Beryl Singleton Bissell is this month's Third Thursday Community Conversation. Thanks for being here, Beryl.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, when I read your memoir, The Scent of God, it had just been released and created considerable buzz at the time. And it's a book filled with spirituality, frustration, sadness, and downright horror. Still, nowhere did I read Poor Me. And I have to ask you why.
I think I was born with a bounce back attitude. My brother used to call me Pollyanna. and basically, this is not something that I did myself. It was a gift. My inborn nature, always to believe that good lies on the other side of tragedy or suffering of any kind, that there's usually something, a blessing tucked in there. You just have to be open to it. And if you harden yourself and if you go into a poor me attitude, it so consumes you that you don't open yourself to what's around you, to the people who are gifts and the surroundings in which you find yourself.
Well, let's get into that a little bit. But first, walk us through life in Puerto Rico and the road to life as a nun.
Yes. Well, my father was not transferred. He was invited to Puerto Rico. The island had just been declared a commonwealth, and they had a program called Operation Bootstrap, which was to build up the industrial side of the island's potential. And the small bank down there, they were all small banks at the time. As a matter of fact, the bank my father joined had little buses that would go to the tiny towns in the mountains. And they didn't have a credit and loan department. But knowing that the island was ready for this big burgeoning growth period, they needed this kind of a banking structure, and they invited my father to build this up. And I was 13 at the time and had grown up on a lake in Saddle River, New Jersey, and was very contented with, I never got bored, let's put it that way. I was always outside and playing around, and I had a little sister, but I didn't have a lot of friends, outside friends. And going to Puerto Rico totally changed this atmosphere. It's a very social place. Popularity is extremely important. And my mother bit right into this popularity thing. And she wanted me to be popular. And all I wanted to do was to be home with my mother. That's how it was. And then one day I was not invited to a birthday party. And I saw everybody come to the classroom. I was going to a private school in Puerto Rico. And they came with their presents all wrapped up. And I didn't even know that this party was happening. And I thought, that's never going to happen to me again. So I right away joined everything. I was on the school newspaper. I was on the debating club. I was a cheerleader. I did everything. And that second year in school, I was elected ideal girl of the school. And my parents thought, this means she's popular. It didn't mean I was popular at all. I was an ideal girl in a Catholic school. it was hard to dispel this desire of my parents that I would become a sought-after young debutante type of person, because I had boyfriends down there, but I never did the debutante scenario. And as a matter of fact, I was kind of shocked and saddened by the discrepancy I saw there between the rich and the poor. And also by the fact that quinceañero, the 15th birthday party, was sort of like putting a girl out on a marriage block. If you were not married by the time you were 21, you were considered an old maid. And I just thought, I don't want anything to do with this, because that's not who I am. And I would see so much suffering down there, and these beautiful people, you know, little boys pulling themselves on carts because they had no legs, and selling shoe shines. You know, even we had maids because they were very cheap, and our gentle, sweet maids that would bring us Puerto Rican food to eat, you know, always reaching out. They were the most generous, kindly people. And I was actually more comfortable with them than I was with the more socially adept teenagers, the flashy, beautiful. I mean, Puerto Rican girls are really beautiful. And they just jingled. And I was sort of plump and slightly overweight at the time. And I just, my sister was popular, though. And I remember once I said, "You have so many friends. How do you make friends?" I was 13 and she was 11. And she said, "Oh, you just ask them to play with you." And I thought, at 13, I don't think I'm going to ask anybody to play with me. So I really did not make a lot of friends until I was in school. And then I was not part of that in-group because I didn't live in Miramar. I lived in Santurce. So I had to travel a bit to get to this school, the Academia Perpetuo Socorro. And I went there because I had originally been sent to a parish school where everybody spoke Spanish. The classes were taught in Spanish. And they put me in a second grade classroom to learn Spanish. And I was so humiliated by being there that I went home. And I was always obedient. But this time I said, "I am never going back to that school. You know, you're just going to have to find another school for me to go to. But I'm not going to sit in a second grade classroom to learn a language." Now I wish I had. You know, it would have been great because my Spanish is, you know, it's acceptable, but it's non-grammatical. It's it's a struggle, let's put it that way. But I can swing into it easily enough in Puerto Rico, and I get along. And it also helped me in Italy learn Italian quickly. So
yeah, the two languages, Romance languages,
very much alike. Yeah.
So, so this was the Catholic school. Now, did that have an influence?
No, not there. We were going to go to Europe on a boat, and there was a boat strike, and we were in New York when they declared this boat strike, waiting to get onto the boat to go to England, and so we just decided to stay there. And while we were there, I went back to the school of Holy Child, where I had gone before we moved to Puerto Rico. It was an all-girls school. I think I had six people in my sixth grade classroom, and it stayed around six till, you know, we got into the high school era. But we went back to visit, and I just loved that place because my father had a drinking problem, and I always remember the struggle to protect. I thought I was protecting my mother from the fact that my father was late or not coming home or whatever. And I assumed the role of being caretaker for my parents. And at the School of the Holy Child, it was a safe environment. I didn't have to take care of my parents because I was there as a boarding student. And it was spiritual and very inspiring. I was taught by nuns in Puerto Rico also, but it was the Holy Child nuns that really affected my whole attitude toward a spiritual way of life. And during this boat strike, we went back to visit the school, and the nuns offered me a full scholarship to come back. I think they knew I was vocation potential, and they wanted me to become a Holy Child nun. But I went back to the school just thrilled, and I went back to the school, and I found all these little holy cards at my place in chapel with Jesus knocking on a door. And
how old were you at this time?
I was 12. Well, I was 15 at this time when I went back.
Yeah.
And I hated these holy cards. I didn't want to become a nun. I really liked the Puerto Rican boys. They're very sexy. And I found American boys terribly boring. But I did not want to be a nun, and I'd shove them over to the girl next to me. But I got very sick, and I had read enough Lives of the Saints to know that sickness can sometimes result in sanctity. And they would always, when they got sick, they would promise God something. And it was usually to serve God in a particular way. And I was running this very, very high fever. I really was jaundiced. And now I have some sort of a hepatitis marker on me, but it's nothing that affects my life, but I can't donate blood. But I got very sick, and my mother and father came to see me because I was running a fever, very high fever, and they thought I was going to die. And as a matter of fact, that night, my mother got hysterical and said to my father, God's going to take her, God's going to take her. And that night was the same night I promised God that if I got better, I would become a nun. I would stop fighting this whole thing. And I did. I got better. The fever abated that very night. And I had been hallucinating. That's one of the things that triggered my fear. And I thought, the nun who, and it wasn't a nun, it was a nurse, a big farm woman who was the nurse in the infirmary at the school. And she bent over to kiss me. And I saw these big shoes. And I thought it was a man. And it was frightening to me. And I thought, I need to get out of this place where I am, where I found myself, and I need to get better. And so I promised God I would become a nun. And I'll tell you, my whole attitude changed almost instantly. I wanted nothing more than to live for God. And I saw the beautiful example of these motherly nuns who were teaching us. And as I said, I loved the quality of spiritual living in the school. Always mass every morning and visits to the chapel. And before you went to bed at night, you had a pop visit, they called it, to chapel. And those times were always sacred to me, but now they assumed a more important role because this was my place to unite with this God that I had promised my life to.
So you were there for 15 years?
In the monastery. Mm-hmm. When I did enter the monastery, I was there for 15 years. Yes.
Okay. So let's move to Vittorio Bosca Pelle.
Yes, right.
Talk about those complicated times.
Yes. My abbess, we were a very strict cloistered order. And my abbess was a very, very traditional nun. So when she called me, and my father had had a stroke, but he had a stroke at a time that we were in a period of penance. It was preparation for Christmas. It was what we called St. Martin's Lent. And we didn't get any letters during that period of time. So I really did not know how ill my father was. But meanwhile, the abbess and the novice mistress had been reading my mail. And when my abbess called me into her office and she said, your father is very, very ill and your mother really can't handle this all by herself. And I think it's God's will. You go to Puerto Rico to take care of him. Well, I had just come out of a period of struggle in the monastery. I became anorexic there, very anorexic. It started as a fasting thing and grew into one place where I could exercise some control over my life. And I had almost been sent home because of this, and I wanted to stay there so badly that I started to eat, forced myself to eat, and resumed my contact with God, because nothing can so separate you from a relationship with God as bearing a sense of guilt and sin within you. And this, I knew all I was thinking about was food all the time. I was not thinking about God. If I was, it was to ask for God's help, but I really didn't want God's help. I really wanted to maintain this one little section of my life where I would be so thin. My mother, who had always been admonishing about my weight, would greet me and she'd say, oh, how thin you've gotten, darling. And instead, she was shocked. She said, you look like a 30-year-old woman. I had big lines on my face. I dropped from 154 to 98 pounds.
Mm.
And the abbess, you know, sent the novice mistress in to talk with my mother. And my mother said, what are you doing to my daughter? She's dying. And the novice mistress said to my mother, your daughter came here to die. And And the whole attitude was to die to self, to live to God, but also to die young was to die in sanctity, more or less. And my mother was so horrified, she took this terrible, terrible dislike to the novice mistress from then on. And I wanted my mother to know that I had a mother there in the monastery, that she didn't need to worry about me because I had my novice mistress. And I had this sort of an infatuated relationship with my novice mistress. I wanted to please her so badly so I could stay a nun. And, well, let's just say it was after she left to found me, go to Bolivia to found a new convent down there, that I was able to forget about her and to move back into a relationship with God. I'd only been there for like 8 months when I got this request to go to Puerto Rico, and I thought, oh, does God know what he's doing? You know, I don't know how I'm going to manage this down there, but I thought I would be a good nun down there because I had my habit, and I wanted badly to live for God, and I didn't realize it would go on for 3 years, that I would be going back and forth to help my father. And meanwhile, I'd met this priest, and I was very, well, first I hated him because I knew he was going to shake up my life. And then one day.
You met him
at church.
In the United States? Or
no, in Puerto Rico. Okay. He used to come to my father's to give communion to my father.
I see.
And the first time, my first morning there, he came out onto the altar to say Mass. And he was very, he had a massive black hair, and he wore dark glasses. And he was very dramatic. He would ask us to sing, and there were only four old ladies and me in church, and he wanted us to sing. And I thought, who is this man? He's so... And I also knew he was going to shake up my life, and I didn't want my life shaken up. So my attitude toward him changed when I gave him a loaf of bread at my mother's request. I baked him bread, and... he took the bread and he held it in his hands as if I'd just given him the baby Jesus. And he said, every morning you come to communion and I think, what is this angel coming to receive communion from me? And now you give me bread. And I looked up and I saw him, how beautifully handsome he was and how his eyes were so full of compassion and wonder. And I sucked it right up.
Apparently.
Yeah.
So then this was obviously a conflicting time for you.
Very, very conflicting.
For how long did that conflict go on?
For 3 years.
Okay.
And it was, I would be down there for 6 months, and then I would go back to the monastery for 6 months. And my sister had also become a poor Claire, and so she would take my place in Puerto Rico. And every time I would go back to the monastery, I'd pray that God would either cure my father or take him, because my vocation was really at risk. And when I tried to explain this to my mother, she said, what kind of a vocation is this if you can lose it so easily? She was not at all sympathetic with the fact that I was struggling with my commitment to religious life and to God. Because she had hated the idea that I was going to enter a monastery in the first place. And she fought it to the bitter end. And when I refused to give in, she let me go, but she told me it would break her heart. And I thought, oh, thank you, thank you. You won't be sorry, because I'm going to become a saint. So anyway, I still wanted to become this saint. I didn't want to be falling in love with a priest. I didn't want anything different. I just wanted to be a good nun. And instead, I had this huge surge of desire within me. I saw so much sensuality in Puerto Rico. Everything was sensuous, the way the flowers grew, the scent in the air, the noises, the embracing, the hugging. And my vocation kept weakening, let's put it that way.
You're listening to Third Thursday Community Conversation, and we're speaking with author Beryl Singleton Bissell. Tell me, Beryl, so what was it like to unbecome a nun, and in Bosca's case, unbecome a priest?
That was a real struggle, because he also wanted to stay a priest. He wanted a spiritual friendship but I knew I was not capable of a spiritual friendship. And I thought, he's in denial if he thinks we can have a spiritual friendship and not let it go beyond that.
Spiritual friendship would be kind of like the old Greek agape.
Yes, kind of exactly, right. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. Where you would,
which of course never works.
No, where you would inspire and encourage one another in your yeah, more or less that's it. And I finally decided that I was no longer committed to religious life and that I'd leave. But up to that point, we'd not shared any of our feelings for one another, but we knew it. You know how you know these things. And I was planning on going to nursing school, and Vittorio asked me, he said, don't go. Please don't go. I've always been a good priest, but I've never been a happy priest, and you've brought happiness back into my life. And so that became he tried to get a dispensation then, and it was a huge struggle, huge, because the church made it very difficult for a priest to seek dispensation. And Vittorio was well known in Puerto Rico. He was a professor at the university and a good friend with many important people down there.
And so also considerably older than you?
Yes, considerably, 25 years older. And my mother knew nothing about this. Meanwhile, we've been conducting this clandestine affair. And it was amazing how my mother remained oblivious. Maybe she wasn't so oblivious. Maybe she knew, but she never wanted to acknowledge it. She finally had to acknowledge it. And when she did, she accepted it wholeheartedly and was right there to support me and my efforts to marry Vittorio.
Now, then you went to live in Italy?
Well, no, we didn't go to live in Italy. My father died, meanwhile. And Vittorio was in Italy seeking his dispensation.
That's right.
And he sent me a ticket, and he said, come, I want to show you Italy. And so my mother said, go. You know, you'll never have an opportunity like this again. So I went. And when I was there, he greeted me at the airport in full cassock. He was dressed as a priest. He had a breviary in his hand. And I remember I looked at him and I said, this is how you greet me? This is what I'm going to travel through Italy with you as a priest? You know, how are we going to do this? You know, you're in Never Never Land here. And he said, you know, you have to trust me. We can do this. So that trip through Italy was an amazingly beautiful but conflicted trip, because we were traveling as brother and sister and sharing rooms. And, you know, somehow he could stay next to me in a room, but I could not stay in a room next to him without wanting to seduce him, let's put it that way. And finally, in a little town called Positano, it was a beautiful little place, and it's one of the most popular places now on the, what is that ride? I can't think of the name of the ride down to Naples, but it's the Amalfi Coast.
Oh, right.
The Amalfi Coast. And we stopped at this place because we had car trouble, and I thought, oh, not more car trouble. The last place we'd had car trouble was a terrible little town, dark and dingy, and I thought, oh, this is going to be another one of those awful places. And instead, it was the most romantic, incredible place you could possibly stop. And I seduced Vittorio there, and we made love. And then we tried hard not, you know, to go back to our original plans to travel as brother and sister. And we did. We did. But it was very hard. But at least I knew I could seduce him.
This is sounding like a movie, Beryl.
Yeah, it does. That sound? Yeah.
So, as I understand it, he had pancreatic cancer.
Yes. It was soon after I went on this trip to Italy with him. He came back to the U.S. and he was very ill. I won't go into the details of what went on in between, but I knew he was very ill, nobody had told him that he had pancreatic cancer. He was operated on in Italy, and I knew I had to tell him. His family didn't tell him. His family wanted him to live his life out with a little bit of happiness that he could have with me. And so they never told him. And I thought, will he want to leave the priesthood if he knows he has pancreatic cancer? So that night I had to tell him. Well, not that night, one night. Mm-hmm. I couldn't bear this secrecy any longer. And I told him. And that night he called Rome and he said, I know I have cancer and I still want my dispensation. And I had a wonderful spiritual advisor, a bishop of Trenton. And I got pregnant that night. I told him that he had cancer. We made love. And I got pregnant right away. And I had to call the bishop and say, can you do anything to speed up this dispensation because I am pregnant? And the bishop laughed and he said, you won't believe it, but the mail just came and I'm holding in my hands Vittorio's dispensation. I mean, it was really so serendipitous. It was... And this is what I found.
I don't know, Beryl, whether that's serendipity or not. I mean, when you go back to the time when you were ill and made your decision to go in, there may be a little more guidance here than you're willing to admit.
Now, you know, somebody made a definition of serendipity as the place where God's grace intersects with our lives.
Well, then maybe that's where we're talking.
And see, that's how I describe it. But yeah.
Well, let's move on. You had two children together.
Yes.
And how long did you actually live with Vittorio?
Vittorio and I were married for 5 years.
I see.
And when he died, the children were 1.5. Francesca was 1.5, and Thomas was 3.5. So they were very little. And Francesca had never really had much of a relationship with Vittorio because he was so terribly ill when I conceived her and gave birth to her. Well, it was really just before I gave birth to her that he became deathly ill. And he had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, but he lived all these years with it. And so the American doctors said it was a misdiagnosis until he got ill just before Francesca was born. And then they found pancreatic cancer had metastasized, and that he didn't have any time left. But he lived another year and a half, so.
Well, the long time had passed between Francesca's birth and her death as an adult and a mother.
Mm-hmm.
So what were you doing during that time? What was your life like?
Well, I was a single mother, and I found it very hard because Vittorio had always been the strength for me. And he knew he was not well, and so we started a little business out of the house, a jewelry business. And he encouraged me. Well, he didn't encourage me. He made me sell the jewelry.
I see.
And he was so much better at it than I was. And we went to one place once, and I remember I didn't sell one thing at that whole little jewelry show. And I thought I was a terrible failure. But as long as Vittorio was with me, I had courage. But when he died, I really threw myself into the business because that's all I had. We didn't have insurance. And I had Social Security for the children. But I actually tripled the size of the business out of the house. But it was such a stressful time. I was fearful all the time. I'd wake up at 2 in the morning and go and do my bookkeeping, you know, and worry. And some things happened. I fell and had a compressed fracture in my back. And one of my customers claimed that the diamond he gave me was not the diamond that he got back in the ring that I set for him. And I had to replace all these things. One of my sales ladies was robbed of a large inventory that I had given her on consignment. And that was not covered by insurance because no insurance companies would cover a home-based jewelry business. So I was absorbing all these losses and becoming more and more fearful and finally decided I need somebody in my life to help me raise the children and to give me that sense of support. And so I I joined a single book lovers club and because I didn't want to go into the single scene. I had some disastrous events there. And I joined a book club that was for people who didn't function well in the single scene, but who had something in common, and that was their love of reading. And so we were encouraged that even if the distance was far away, that you could still establish a friendship that might lead to more than friendship. And I fell in love with this particular man. It was a very fast courtship. lots of letters. I only met him once when he proposed to me, that same time he came out to visit. And he was the best thing I'd seen so far. So I accepted. And we moved to Minnesota. That's how I got out here in Minnesota. But he was charming and funny before we were married. And then after we were married, it was a different man. And we lived in let's say, fear all the time of displeasing him. So eventually, 10 years later, I tried to make this marriage work. I sensed in the children such frightening changes because they were angry, because they had never been allowed to express an opinion. And I was staying with him. I kept staying with him because I thought that we were resilient. We were more resilient than he was, and he needed our love. And so I thought, well, we could always rebound, but the children didn't rebound. And so that's when I finally asked for divorce. But I stayed in Minnesota because I loved it here. And I'd started going to school as a single parent and I'd met wonderful people and had found out I was a writer. I had never known that before, but my English professor discovered that. And so that's more or less in between.
Well, Francesca was 24 when she was murdered.
Yes, she was. And after I divorced this man, the children moved into a period of terrible turmoil. They were very angry with me. And I had been warned about this. They were teenagers. Francesca was 12 and Thomas was 14. And it was a very dark and frightening period because they were both so angry. And no amount of counseling seemed to be able to resolve any issues between us. Even though I knew they loved me and they knew I loved them and that I was always there for them, they still, they were teenagers too, let's put it that way. Every teenager tries to break away from their parent, especially when we'd been close because the three of us had been against this one dominant figure, not against him, but fearful of him, let's put it that way. So we had been close, and then they didn't understand why I'd stayed so long. And I didn't want them to know that I was divorcing him because of them, because they needed to be safe. I told them that Daddy and I weren't happy anymore. And so then that was thrown in my face. Oh, you know, we could be unhappy, but it's only when you're unhappy that you divorce him. And so Thomas resumed. He was a resilient boy, and he was the one I was most worried about because he had learning disabilities, and I really worried about Tom. And Fran was my good little girl. She had always been such a good student, and she was always helping me and wanting to be with me. And even during this period of turmoil, she wanted to be with me all the time. And she wanted to be with me, and then she hated the fact that she wanted to be with me. So she was very beautiful. And when she suddenly came into her puberty, she was magnificent, let's put it that way. And a lot of boys wanted to be with Francesca. And she wanted to be loved, I suppose, and to feel good about herself. And so she schoolwork became less and less important, and she got involved with the wrong kind of friends, and started drinking, and from there it was a real downward course. So she kept trying to get better. She was in and out of treatment programs, and she, every time she'd fall back, she'd feel like such a loser, and she just hated being a loser. And she called herself this, and I said, Fran, I said, every day you have the chance to change, every minute. You know, you don't, just because you made a mistake doesn't mean that you can't change that. Because I really believed that we all have the power within ourselves. But of course, I wasn't that cognizant of the effect of alcohol on a child who probably had a chemical imbalance anyway. She had been born, you know, during a period of when my husband was ill. And who knows what existed within her during her when she was within me. Yeah.
Well, now, as I understand it, you were never really satisfied with the murder investigation? Did that finally resolve itself?
No, it's never resolved itself. And it's a complex thing because there was a young man with her who was shot also and who has never talked to the police. And he survived and she didn't. And there are all sorts of possibilities. She was coming home to live with us the day she died. And she had gone to live with this young man for safety's sake because she had gone on a route that was very dangerous. And she had asked to come home because Minneapolis was a bad place for her. And I knew she wanted to get better. And so I said, oh, yes. And I didn't want her to go back. But she said she had to give her notice at work. And she went back. And then the night she was coming home, she died. So
talk about 7 years in hell.
Yeah. Well, yeah, 7 years in hell. But, you know, after she died, it was such a horrible ordeal. And yet I didn't have to worry about her anymore. That sounds so strange, but in some ways it was a relief because she was at peace now, finally. She'd wanted peace all her life, and finally she had it.
Now, 7 years in hell is an essay you wrote, right?
Yes, it is. Right. And that was during the period when she was a teenager. Mm. That was prior to her death.
Okay.
And
that's in a collection of anthology?
Yes, an anthology, right.
You're listening to Third Thursday Community Conversation, and we're talking with Beryl Singleton Bissell, author of The Scent of God and A View of the Lake. Now, let's move to the lake.
Yeah.
Schroeder, in particular, when did you decide to live the Lake Superior dream?
Well, I was working at a wonderful literary press in Minneapolis because I wanted to be a writer, and when you're working for a literary press, you don't write. And prior to working there, I had taken classes at the Loft and had won a couple of awards, some fairly big ones for my writing. And I met this wonderful man through an intern at work. And we had a blind date and fell in love. And 3 years later, we finally married. I was not going to marry again because I didn't want to find the other man on the other side of the wedding ring that I discovered in that other marriage. And I was up here at Norcroft, and
yeah, that's the
writer's retreat for
Joan
women.
Drury,
yes,
yeah.
Joan Drury, and I was writing the bones of the book, The Scent of God, which eventually was the first book that was published. And I knew how wonderful it was up there, and how much Bill would love it. And so Joan shed this sort of a rumor that Bill had not only proposed to me while I was up here at Lutzen at that writer's retreat, but that I had said I would only marry him if we moved to the North Shore. So that wasn't exactly how it was.
No, but Joan writes mystery stories.
Yeah,
it does sound like a plot to me.
It sounds great, and it was wonderful because this is where I knew we were supposed to be living already back then. But then Bill discovered the same thing. He just formed this inner desire to move here, and when we saw this house for sale by owner, and we fell in love with it, and we were crazy, and we put a check down, and then we went back to Minneapolis, and we thought we're out of our minds. You know, we don't know anything about living up there. We couldn't even remember what the house looked like. But I knew we were meant to be here. And Bill finally said, Beryl, if you promise to finish that book, which he really believed in, will you promise that if we move up there? And I said, oh, yes, 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 I will finish that book. And so we did. We got up here and we moved here. And I was so intoxicated with the place that I found myself living in that I didn't pay any attention to this book. Instead, I got involved in community and got very involved in the Historical Society and did oral histories and got to meet some of the old timers who were descendants of the first settlers, and was privileged to interview them and sit in their homes and look at albums and have cookies. And
oh, cookies. Wait, oh, yeah. When was this about when you moved here?
We moved here in 1998.
Okay.
And
now the book was completed.
No, it wasn't completed at all.
No, but it has been completed.
Oh, yes, yes.
Was it completed here?
Oh, absolutely. It was, okay. And it was written totally up here. This is where it was primarily written. And
so how long did that take you?
Writing the book?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, a good 6-7 years. Oh. But it had been in formation, let's put it that way, for at least 10 years, because I had started the first chapter prior to moving up here. Mm-hmm. And Bill knew the story of my life, and he really thought it was a story that other people should hear.
Well, now let's talk about the second book. Because
mm-hmm.
Everything we've been talking about so far is pretty much a part of Scent of God.
Right.
But A View of the Lake. Now, this is not just a book about the exterior landscape.
No, not at all.
Okay, so talk about a sense of place or the interior sense of being and how the living in these surroundings affect you spiritually.
It affected me in many ways. Spiritually, I became a different person up here. I was suddenly aware that this place had a lot to teach me. It had a lot to teach me by powers of observation, but also recognizing the changes within myself. It's really hard to describe, but everything spoke to me up here. It wasn't just the lake. It was, finding the wildflowers in the woods and looking at them with a jeweler's loop and seeing the incredible intricacy of these tiny perennials in the woods that, were all over, and you never notice them unless you see that first one and you go looking for these things. And I became a pilgrim up here, a pilgrim to recognize, I guess, the miracles that surrounded me and the miracles that lay within me, to recognize these things. And I started writing a column for the Cook County News Herald. And in those columns, I was able to share some of the new insights I was gaining. And the columns became quite popular, got a lot of fan mail. Some of the letters were rather nasty to the editor. But it was all part of the learning experience. It really honed my writing skill, too. So,
well, you talk about that everything, not just the lake. But I'd like you to talk about one thing. In the book, you talk about the power of winter ice.
Yeah.
And that's always something that's resonated with me, too.
Mm-hmm.
But especially when it piles up on the shore.
I had never seen that.
Is that a metaphor?
No, it is a metaphor, okay. Of course. It is a metaphor in so many ways, because I thought they would be there forever. They were so huge, and they disappeared so quickly. So that pain and Trent, I'm groping for words here, but pain and difficulties and tragedies, they're there definitely, and there are heaps of ice and they're mountainous, but they disintegrate. And they change you because they've flooded you. The waters from those ices have sort of taken you elsewhere.
But you write about the power of that ice.
Oh, it was like I thought we'd gone to war. It sounded like bombers going over all night long. We couldn't sleep. And we didn't know really what was happening until the morning, and we looked out our window, and there was this mountain of ice and chunks being hurled up into the air with such force that they, some of them landed on our neighbor's porch, and they were the size of, a gas barrel.
A 50-gallon drum.
Yeah, 50-gallon drum, yeah.
So even though it had a tremendous amount of power, you also said that it melts away.
It melts, yes, it does. And the same thing with grief. It's there always. I've recognized that there's this deep hole within me, but the raw edges have healed. And with regard to my daughter's death, I'm not even sure it's necessary to find out how she died. I'm not even sure I want to know, because maybe I don't. What's better, suicide? What's better, murder? And there were both possibilities there. So
now let's talk a little bit about writing in general. Mm-hmm. Because you're still doing that. You've got a very active webpage, blog.
Yeah.
A lot of newsletters, and much the same, although more expanded than what you wrote for the newspaper, but very personal, and as well as they are newsletters about what's going on. You also do a lot of speaking to book clubs and that kind of thing. You've got a huge list.
Mm-hmm.
But so you call the space you work in, you call a Little Red writing show.
Yes.
So why is a separate space?
Because at Norcroft. Norcroft was founded so that a woman could get away from her daily life and create, because you really can't create when you're amidst the hubbub of a daily living. And so that's what I found there. We had a little writing shed. Each one of us did. And that's where I wrote this book, The Scent of God. And I got that writing shed when Norcroft closed.
Oh.
I had been working there as a temporary caretaker when the caretaker went on vacation. And so Joan offered me a writing shed. All I had to do was get it picked up and brought to my house. And you know, Jay, it was the same shed I'd written this book in. I hadn't asked for that one, but I got the same exact writing shed.
We're going to retitle this program Serendipity.
Yeah.
That's the third serendipitous issue. Now, A View of the Lake, was that written in the Little Red Shed?
Well, no, because that did not come until later on. I had already started writing that book, and I've only had it there for a few years now.
Okay.
Norcroft has not been closed that long. But I think a lot of it was probably written there, but it was in between. You know, the shed came, and I was already writing this book. So,
well, this you belong to a group of single book lovers and worked for a small publishing. But in one of your newsletters, you say that if a person likes to read, they might also like writing.
Yes.
So, what advice do you have for readers who might want to become writers?
Read as a writer would. You know, I my granddaughter never realized that she could write poetry until I sent her out to look at our brook when I had fallen and I couldn't get outside. And she didn't know what to look for. And I said, you're a reader. Go outside and look at it as a writer would, because we just had those heavy rains. And I knew our brook would be really roaring. And she came back in like 40 minutes later and she sat down in front of me and she had written a poem. She had what it had elicited in her, just going and looking at something as a writer would. I'll tell you, if you want to be a writer, you must read. Because if you want to become a writer and you don't read, you'll never make it.
That's, you don't know how words work.
No, you don't know how they work, right?
So, writing can be hard enough, but getting published can be a little bit like crossing the Rubicon.
Ooh, yes.
Was that a reasonably pleasant experience for you, or is that the struggle that I often hear from writers?
Well, I'll tell you, the first book was a pleasant experience. It was miraculous, really. It had been turned down by an agent who said, I loved it. I read it straight through, but you haven't told the story yet. You have to go back and redo it. And so I did. And once I did, an agent fell in love with it and sold it within a day of having received it. You know, it was amazing. So that was very pleasant. But and this book was pleasant because I knew where it belonged with Lake Superior. You know, I didn't think it belonged out there in the larger world with a New York publisher. And but this sequel to The Scent of God that I'm writing right now.
Is that still entitled The Glass Chrysalis?
Or The Glass Chrysalis is what I'm thinking of titling it. And it's more or less my daughter was a butterfly. But as she strove to emerge, the glass, you know, the chrysalis shattered around her and left her without the power to fly. So
so how are we doing with that?
We're struggling. I thought it was finished. And I sent it to the agent, and the agent said, you know, I love you so dearly, Beryl, but she said, this is not finished. You know, you've got to work at this some more. And I said, well, if I rewrite it, will you be willing to look at it again? And she said, I think it needs other eyes. So this has been very painful because I had a great agent, and now I know she's not willing to look at this book again, and so I'm going to have to find another agent. And just getting back, you know, it really deflated me. I think up to that point I had thought, I was writing well, and I know I am writing well. It is a good book, but it's not cohesive enough. It's not tight enough. And there are places where I've left the reader in the dark, and I didn't realize it because I know the story so well, but it's hard to know what the reader, what kind of questions the reader will come up with. So I sent it out to 9 more people to read, and it's amazing the insights that have come back. And now I'm ready to resume work on this book, but I'm scared. Let's put it that way.
Well, A Scent of God is pretty brutally honest.
Yeah.
And there's really no punches pulled. The View from the Lake is a little more esoteric in the sense that
it was a happy book to write.
Yeah, you weren't dealing with tragedy.
Yeah.
Other than the, you know, the circular events of nature and that kind of thing, which is really not tragic.
Yeah.
So is this, is the Glass Chrysalis, are you capable of making that brutally honest? Does it call for that?
It will have to be. You know, because I have this inner demand that, you know, it's useless to hide from facts. And you get tangled up when you do. And that's, it's actually readers relate to something that they can relate to because they've all suffered loss. They've all suffered guilt. All the readers, maybe they've lived totally different lives.
But are you a different person now than when you, because it's been years since you wrote Son of God.
Yeah.
Not necessarily wrote it, but that the events transpired. And then in the meantime, you've got what you just said is a happy book. You know, is it going to be hard to go back to face that? And is that what part of the fear is?
Well, no, because I did go back and face it, you know, and I have. And I've been working on it for like 4 years and wept a lot. I'll tell you, you cry a lot and you agonize a lot. But what I've learned in both books was that basically I'm a good person. What a relief. You know, that's such a relief to find that you did the best you could, because we can be so harsh on ourselves. If only we'd done this differently. And certainly when you've lost a child, you're always doing the if only questions. And there are if onlys, but there are also the choices that my daughter made, as well as the choices that I made. So
things you didn't have any direct control over.
Right.
No. So what's next?
Well, the book.
Now you're thinking beyond that. I know you are.
Yeah.
Somebody.
Well, you know, I do. I have another book in mind. It's fiction, and it's really based on what I don't know about my mother. And because she had an incredibly interesting life, she married a bigamist as a teenager and was somehow brought into the into Canada, smuggled in on a boat by this bigamist who later she escaped from, and all these things. I have the marriage license. You know, one of my relatives in England sent me this marriage license that she married this man. She was 18 years old, and so I have that, but I don't know what boat she came on or how she did this and so it has to be fiction, you know, and I don't know a whole lot about her life as a child. I only know it was brutal, but, I'd like to edge myself into fiction, and I'm even thinking a little bit of this, The Glass Chrysalis, as maybe taking that into fiction too, so I can get closer to the story by, you know, getting out of that first person voice and going into a third person who can observe. But I don't know. I'm scared. I don't know if I can do that yet. So
we only have a few minutes left, and I want to return because there's an interesting piece that I read. I believe it is one of your newsletters. You went back to the monastery.
Yeah. I wrote an article about that was in the Trenton Times.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Oh, that was amazing. Well, when the nuns were selling the monastery because it was too big, they needed a smaller one. And so I was writing The Scent of God at the time, and I was doing a lot of research, and I thought, I want to go back there. I want to verify my memories there. I'd been back to interview the nuns many, many times, but I'd not been inside the monastery. And I went back to do this because I knew that realtors had been there and archivists and antiquarians, whatever, had been through that monastery. It's an old building. And I thought I would be allowed in there too, but I wasn't because I was no longer a nun. So I promised myself that when the nuns had moved out, I was going back there. And I did. I went back there and managed to contact the owner just a week before the monastery was going to be renovated and turned into a senior citizens residence. And they were knocking down walls and all sorts of things. But she had never gone through the monastery with a nun. She didn't know what half these rooms were for. And so I went back as a returner to verify my memories, and I became a tour guide to this place that I hadn't been in 30 years or so. You know, it'd been a long time. So it was an amazing experience. And they had some very strange ideas about what some of the rooms were used for. There was one soundproofed room that they thought had been used for exorcisms. Exorcisms, yeah. So, yeah.
Well, that's comes from being on the outside, not the inside.
Yeah.
Beryl, what are you glad you did and what do you regret you did?
You know, I'm glad I did everything. I think what I wish I had done sooner, what I regret not doing sooner, was leaving that marriage sooner. But, well, I learned a lot about what a woman goes through who is not in a physically abusive relationship, but is controlled and frightened to death, you know, by this mental control, and to see the destructiveness of that. And I remember going to a battered woman's group. I didn't think I belonged there, but I was sent there after they found out that I was in this relationship with a man I couldn't talk to, and found out that really my situation was worse because I didn't have broken bones to show. And so right away you think we're the crazy ones. You know, obviously he's right and we're wrong, because what do I have to show? I don't have anything to show except changes within ourselves that we became frightened people. So that was a learning experience, because I think myself, I would have wondered why people don't get out of abusive relationships sooner. Why do they stay? And it's not just fear of leaving. It's because you feel you're responsible for the fact that you aren't as they want you to be. So
that'll have to do it for tonight. You've been listening to Third Thursday Community Conversation. We've been speaking with Beryl Singleton Bissell. She's author of The Scent of God, a memoir, and A View of the Lake, and maybe soon, The Glass Chrysalis. Join me again on October 18th when we'll be back with another edition of Third Thursday. Thank you, Beryl.
Thank you for allowing me to come and talk.
I'm Jay Anderson. Thirsty Boots is next.